The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they're easy, but because they are hard.
Start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting for 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
And good evening, everybody. Welcome to our Tuesday evening California time Space Show program. I'm your host, David Livingston, and thank you for joining us. And we have a very special program tonight because one of my all-time favorite guests is back with us, Dallas Benoff. We go way, way, way back, and it's really great that he is back on the program. But let me do a couple of introductory things first, and then we'll start talking to Dallas. For those of you who would like to call and speak with Dallas, it is toll-free 1-866-687-7223. Remember, the toll-free line is the preferred way of communicating with us during live show time. But you can also use email, drspace, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. And you can also send a note on our blog, which is the spaceshow.com website, all the way over to the far right to the upcoming show menu. This is the first show listed. That is our blog page as well as archive page for this program. So open it up, and comments are all the way down at the bottom. As soon as you post your comment or your question, I'll get it, and then I can bring it up on air as soon as possible, or depending on what you're asking, when appropriate. But again, we prefer the toll-free line, 1-866-687-7223. While you're at our website, which again is thespaceshow.com, do check out our website newsletter. You'll see it center right, and it is uploaded fresh Sunday afternoon after our Sunday program. It has all of what is planned for this week in some detail. And then if you continue to scroll down, you'll see the programming we have planned throughout the balance of the year. We have one date left in September, and then we're filling October, November, and December already. Lots of dates are already filled in December. It's moving really, really fast, and I still think we're back in February, so I'm being left at the post, I think. But everything we do is archived, and you can listen off of our site or easily download these programs, and you can download them very quickly if you have a high-speed internet. There is a store if you're interested in Space Show t-shirts and logo wear, and that is in the upper left-hand corner of our homepage. You'll see it under support. And there is also another item under that left-handed menu at the top called Listen Live. So please share this information for people who may not be familiar with the Space Show. But this tells you how to listen to live programs. They're all streaming, by the way. And also how to listen to MP3 compressed programs for the archives off the website. And then the podcast on the various servers, including Alexa, the TuneIn player, which can handle all podcasts but also handles Alexa, is embedded on that page as well. If you do have any podcasting questions or any other concerns, email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. And remember that everything we do is archived and put up on the website for your listening pleasure at your convenience. The most important information on the homepage to me is supporting the Space Show, so please do remember we're a nonprofit, 501c3, and we're listener-supported, so that means that because of many of you, we're able to bring you these programs. So if you like the programming and like talking to the guest and interacting with them and the subject matter and like having access to all of this, please do support us. So remember, if you're a federal U.S. taxpayer, your gift is tax deductible on the federal side. The same is true for California. And, you know, your support really is crucial. So we absolutely thank you for your support and for those of you who will be supporting us in the near future. And if you have questions, do check out our nonprofit parent site, onegiantleapfoundation.org, or simply email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. And we also have sponsors, so the sponsors get those banner messages you see on our homepage. With their sponsorship, they can change their sponsor banner anytime they want. And on full-length programs, which is what we have tonight, I do read short sponsor messages to the first segment and the second segment. So for the first segment tonight, Northrop Grumman is a sponsor with a leading global security company message. They provide innovative systems, products, and solutions to both the government and private commercial customers on a global basis. They have amazing capabilities and technology ranging from undersea to outer space and cyberspace. We are also sponsored by the Space Foundation, which is spacefoundation.org. Right now they have their space report up on their homepage. This is sort of a Bible of the commercial as well as the public space industry globally. It tells you all the economics and the sectors and what's happening on an annualized basis. It's a really important report. Check it out on their website, thespacefoundation.org. The Space Development Network sponsors us, and this is an online organization allowing you as a space advocate to join together with others to advance the plan for space development, which really means to advance space settlement. And they're looking for people with a wide variety of interest and skills. It's a free network to join, and their website is spacedevelopment.org. So do check it out. And we're fortunate to have the National Space Society sponsoring us. Besides their terrific ISDC event, and it really is an event, which is every Memorial Day or around Memorial Day, they also have white papers and other committees and other meetings during the year. Many of them address interests that are close to all of the space show listeners, such as space settlement. So they have a new website address. It's space.nss.org. You can probably get redirected if you just go to nss.org. But they did ask me to start using the new website, and their wish is my command. So as I said a few minutes ago, Dallas Binhoff is back with us, and it is really great to have Dallas with us. So he is now the founder of CIS Lunar Space Development Company, LLC, which was established in June of 2017 to create commercial transportation from low Earth orbit to the moon surface and everything in between. And prior to starting this new company, Dallas was with Boeing, and he was a space architect, project manager, capture team lead, and proposal manager, focusing on human space exploration missions and commercial opportunities. He developed concepts for the moon and Mars, human exploration missions, lunar habitats, propellant depots, space tugs, moon shuttles, commercial space stations, crew return vehicles, and reusable launch vehicles. You should read his entire bio. It is up on the Space Show website. Dallas has had many impressive years with Boeing in the space industry and has been a frequent guest on the Space Show. We're really lucky to have him back with us. So, Dallas, welcome back, and we're anxious to hear about CIS Lunar Space Development Company. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, David. Thanks for embellishing the intro.
All true, of course. No embellishment here.
Yeah, no. It's good to be back. It's good to be able to talk about what I think needs to be done, what several people think needs to be done in CIS Lunar Space, and what a lot of people will be needing in the near future.
So starting at the beginning, is CIS Lunar Space the first area to address, or is going to the moon the first area to address, or going to Mars the first area to address, or a orbiting space station the first area to address? If you're getting to set the priorities, do we go after developing CIS Lunar first?
It's all of the above. Now, really, it's CIS Lunar includes the moon, in my book anyway. It includes L2. It includes the moon. It is the volume of space between the Earth and the moon. And I look at that as a spherical volume, not as a flat plane. Back and forth to moon, to the moon. Leo is pretty well busy with space station and all the companies proposing to put up additional space stations, private and otherwise. Through the NASA had a recent proposal for fostering Leo commercialization, all about expanding what's going on in low Earth orbit. Their Bigelow has been pursuing this for years, waiting for transportation. NASA is doing the Mars thing and the Moon thing. Mars is kind of the edge of the frontier where I think NASA belongs. And getting to Mars involves the Moon today with the Gateway as a program. I believe it's a program of record. At least it's being pursued, and the first element is being purchased, the power and propulsion element. There are companies, countries, and people anxious to get to the moon's surface, and we're about helping to make that happen.
So how do you make it happen? And are we at a tipping point yet where if we had routine back and forth Earth lunar transportation, it could be profitable and commercial?
That really depends. It depends on what's on the moon that can be useful. It depends on whether we need to export from the moon to be profitable, or whether we just need to take people back and forth because they want to go back and forth. And I think reusability is the key to making it more affordable and a growth industry. We keep throwing away upper stages. We keep throwing away launch vehicles. We continue to talk about expendable landers and maybe reusable ascent stages. And we keep talking about propellants that aren't easily accessible in space. And we need to change that conversation to have in-space infrastructure that we use hundreds of times, refueling, using propellants that come from resources that are in space or on the moon or on Mars, and not build new hardware every time, and reduce the size of launch vehicles that are needed to get us into our destinations. And there are a lot of new small launch vehicles coming online that can reach not only low Earth orbit, their intended target, but GEO and interplanetary and the moon, if there were infrastructure in place to take their customers from LEO to a destination.
So where are the bottle points? What are the hang-ups? Why isn't it happening? Or let's say, why isn't it happening really rapidly where we all see it happening?
There's no perceived market or a product from this, in my view. It's like kind of in an age when Ted Turner started CNN, you know, 24-hour news channel. Who's going to buy that? Who's going to subscribe to it? It's just not going to work. And Ted did it because it felt right. There are people that want to go to the moon. There are people that want to go mine the moon and use the resources there for leaving the moon, for living on the moon, and perhaps for going on to Mars. And we just need to go see if that's possible. The latest information came out a couple of weeks ago on the availability of water ice on the moon was that in some spots there may be as much as 30% water ice in the regolith. We don't know how deep that may be. We don't know how widespread that may be, but this is a factor of 6 greater than what LCROSS told us when it slammed into the moon several years ago, and we analyzed the plume from that, from the permanent shadow crater. So it's at higher concentrations, the cost to extract will be less, but we don't know if the cost will be less than getting it from Earth, and we need to know that. And we need to get people elsewhere in cislunar space. We need to allow the fireflies, the the Rocket Labs, the Relativity Rocket folks, and the Boeing DARPA XS-1, or Phantom Express, as it's now called, deliver payloads to low Earth orbit and then pick those payloads up and take them to GEO, take them to SunSync, take them to L1, take them to the moon. And so there's a change in launch dynamics coming that will help enable or bring about a change in space transportation.
So what's missing? I mean, how does it get started?
The big thing that's missing is the thing that's always missing, and that's money to develop the things that need to be put in place.
And does your company work on trying to establish that market? What are your goals?
Well, our goal is to put this transportation system in place to get us from low Earth orbit to L1 to the moon's surface and back. Got to come back. It can't be one way. And so we're talking with customers. Potential customers. We're talking with potential collaborators. We're talking with potential suppliers, and we're talking with NASA. We're talking at conferences. We're starting to broaden out the conferences we talk to. We'll be talking in not the new space conferences as much in the coming year, but in conferences related to satellites, potential customer conferences, and trying to offer an opportunity to change the way we do business, or offer an opportunity to expand a launch provider's market, offer an opportunity to change the way we design and build GEO satellites. And basically getting the word out in how things can change in the future.
So, for you, where do you start? I mean, do you have a product that you want to sell, or do you have a service that you're trying to get people interested in buying?
Yeah, our product is a service. So the service is transportation. So I'm gonna pop something new out there and remind people of Deep Purple's hit song in the 70s called Space Truckin'. We are a space trucking company. We want to pick up satellites, people, cargo from low Earth orbit and move them to a different destination and come back and do it again. And that primary destination, our ultimate goal, is to reach out to the moon with our landers and come back. And in that infrastructure would be space tugs or space trucks, space locomotives, several different names that connotate the same thing. Things that push payloads around, things that push railroad cars around, and move those out and have propellant depots, space docks or cross docking facilities or truck stops. Again, lots of different names for the same thing. Gateways is another familiar name these days, and where we can receive water from Earth or from any other destination, as long as it's cheaper than from Earth, convert that into oxygen and hydrogen, refuel our space tugs, send them out to L1 with cargo, do the same thing at L1, convert water to oxygen and hydrogen, send payloads down to the lunar surface, send people down to the lunar surface, come back up to L1. And then eventually, when we get the moon miners on the moon, the moon village on the moon, start buying water on the moon, again, if it's cheaper than bringing our own propellant to leave the moon, and reduce that cost of transport back and forth, that opens up more and more markets as more and more people use it, as the cost continues to go down.
Is there a plan or a target for an anchor user, like an anchor tenant in a business park or a shopping center, to kind of get everything kick-started and going? Is there an initial client, the government or somebody, to sort of prime the pump with a commercial activity to get everything going?
That's not a primary goal of ours, to have an anchor tenant or to rely on government funds to kick this off, but we would be foolish not to reach out and propose to accept those if they're made available, like the Lunar COTS program that Allison Zuniga talks about, Dr. Zuniga from NASA Ames, or Doug Plata talks about. That's what's going on right now on the NASA side. They are offering to buy payload services now at the Astrobotic Moon Express, the former Google Lunar XPRIZE competitor-sized payloads. They're offering to buy rides for payloads once they've demonstrated they can get to the moon. And there was a recent NASA request for information about medium and large-sized landers, medium being in the 500-kilogram payload range, and large meaning 5,000 kilograms for human-capable missions, whether that be from low Earth orbit or from the Gateway or from anywhere in between. So NASA's talking about potentially buying transportation services to the moon for their payloads. Jan Werner, director of ESA, is talking about Moon Village, which is basically a common location where multiple people go for multiple reasons, not as a government program, not as a government funded, but a single location where shared resources can occur. And also, and from my view, shared transportation. If anybody could get to L1, then there could be a single path down to the moon from L1 to the moon surface and back. So that's kind of what we're leaning on. We're leaning on looking at multiple customers. I have talked with half a dozen potential customers that want to go to four different locations in cislunar space. So that being geosynchronous, L1, the moon surface, and the Gateway.
So, on lots of people who listen to the space show are not very supportive of the Gateway for a whole bunch of reasons. But I'm taking from you that you think the Gateway is probably a pretty good idea.
I think a place to change from one transportation vehicle to another, from one flight environment to another, is necessary in a reusable architecture. I think the main reason people are against the Gateway, the NASA Gateway, is, number one, it detracts from what they want to do. Number two, it's in a particular orbit that is chosen because Orion can get there. It can't get to any other location in the moon's vicinity. And people see it as a delaying factor for getting to Mars or for getting to the moon or as a budget eater, a la space station. I mean, there are many reasons to be against it. The function, in my view, is needed. And we have two of those in our architecture. They're called propellant depots. They're where our stages are parked between missions. They're where they're refueled. They're where we change payloads from one vehicle type to another.
You have a phone call and an email that I've been sitting on. I'll go ahead and do the email, and I think the phone call is Marshall. So Marshall's a fellow Okie with me, and he can wait a minute. and if I'm misreading caller ID and it's not Marshall, my deepest apology. But Bijan is in Sweden, and he says, with reusable launchers, why not launch all fuel from Earth instead of setting up chemical industries in space?
Initially, we will be launching propellant from Earth, and that's oxygen and hydrogen for our concept. It has a very low density, however, and it's very cold. It is much easier to transport water from the Earth. It's much easier to store water. And we can transfer that or transpose that water from to liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen in our propellant depots. We have the energy available from the sun. We have the time we need between missions. We already electrolyze water at the space station for the astronauts there. We don't do it at the quantities I'm talking about, but and then the liquefaction, there are cryo coolers that NASA has tested and is testing that that keep oxygen and hydrogen cold, and we just need to push those a little, those technologies a little bit harder to enable us to liquefy and hold liquids without boil off. So water is everywhere, and water is the source of oxygen and hydrogen, which is the best propellant we have for use in space. And so that's why we're proposing to do this. The emailer is right in that everything initially will come from the Earth. And until and unless the cost of getting it from somewhere else is less than getting it from Earth, we will continue to get it from Earth.
Okay, and now we'll go to our phone. Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. And is this Marshall?
Yeah. Anyway, you kind of half answered the question by the previous question, but I'll go ahead. And it sounds like you have two sources of energy possible in space, one being space-based solar power, which generally brings to mind, you know, big photovoltaic array, and the other is nuclear power. Which comes first, and which one do you think really wins?
It depends on what you want to do. But solar energy is there now. Solar energy is not controversial to get launched. Station uses solar power, 100 kilowatts. Arrays are getting smaller and more efficient, easier to deploy. Nuclear devices, in the U.S. anyway, there are political concerns and grassroots concerns about launching nuclear reactors of the fission type due to the potential for an accident and dispersing radioactive material. Although they're well protected, that is a concern, and safety is always up there as one of the top reasons for being extra careful. So I think there's a role for both. Solar energy will definitely be first. I'm not talking space-based solar power like I think you're referring to, the 5 to 10 gigawatts to beam down to Earth. I'm talking about solar arrays, much like the station has, to service our needs at the propellant depots.
So you're really talking about small. What about producing nuclear fuel from mining the moon?
Don't know personally that much about whether there is uranium on the moon. I do know that there's thorium on the moon that mm-hmm. could be used if we had thorium reactors. But that would be, if from my view, that's for the people who want to, this is probably a dirty word to some, develop the moon and make it livable, usable, productive. I want to get their stuff to the moon so they can do that. But that's for others to decide.
Oh, you bring up a good point. It's probably better to leave the reactors on the moon, nicely buried, et cetera, rather than put it into space.
Yeah, if that's where we get the fuel from, you're correct.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting thought, but I'd really like to see a nice big solar power station up there generating electricity and, you know, like beaming it around to power other space stations and other stuff too.
Yep. No, I worked on those in the National Security Space Office study back in 2007. It was published in 2007 with my friends Coyote Smith and Pete Gerritsen and many others, Eva Jane Lark. Many in the community did that pro bono for the report that came out. Paul Damphousse was another one. And that was for powering the Earth with clean, carbon-free electricity. And it doesn't replace everything, but it should be part of the portfolio we have for energy. Gary Barnhart, ex-ISP, is looking at implementing a demonstration of beaming power between spacecraft in orbit, near and around and to and from the space station. To do just what you're suggesting.
Mm-hmm. I do remember when Coyote Smith was on the space show. Really enjoy that, too.
Yep.
So if you see him, tell him hi.
I will do that.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, Marshall. Thanks.
Thank you, Marshall.
Bye.
Listeners, that opens up the line if you would like to use it. It is 1-866-687-7223. Do you see cislunar tourism as a big commercial component or more marginal, but definitely a commercial component?
I think it's a definite commercial component. We have in our architecture a personnel module, a bus, a camper, if you will, that is a payload for our space tugs to move people from low Earth orbit to L1 down to the moon and back. So we see moving people, whether it's astronauts or moon miners or tourists, as one of the jobs that is in our portfolio.
Does that happen soon, or is that a down-the-road activity?
In the plan we've laid out, it's down the road, but the timing really, really depends on who wants what when, who the customer is, what they want, and when they want it. If we had a customer that wanted to land a payload on the moon immediately, our concepts will allow us to do that. And we can go straight to transfer vehicles and landers, or straight to landers with just-in-time refueling to get the job done. If the customer was more interested in getting a payload to the surface and not so much getting anything back and was in a hurry, we could even build a lander and have it be expendable. Of course, that would drive the customer's cost up, but our architecture is defined such that we can do things like that.
Email is from Jack in Tucson, and he says, do you have competition? Is there a race for cislunar development? And what about competition between other space nations like China or Russia?
Yeah, there's definitely competition out there. If anyone were to tell an investor they had no competition, they would be looked at funny. Other ideas out there include ULA, Cislunar 1000. Very similar concept in terms of propellant use, in terms of moon tug or space tugs, in terms of moon shuttles or landers. Their concept is based around converting an upper stage of their upcoming Vulcan vehicle, long duration storage, propellant transfer. So at the 50,000 foot level, that concept is very similar to ours. Different capabilities, different designs, but very similar. Paul Spoudis, may God rest his soul, we lost him 2 weeks ago, wrote a book called The Value of the Moon, which describes the architecture that he and Tony Lavoie, former NASA Marshall engineer, put together that used SLS and Orion initially, put mining equipment on the moon robotically, got propellant up, and describes in detail how that is done and puts that out. So there's another competing idea. On the other hand, ESA, in talking about going to the moon from the gateway, Jan Werner's director, Werner, has said that they want to buy rides to the surface. They don't want to build the lander. They want to focus on the payloads. So they want to buy rides. Governments around the world want space technology for what it can do to their economy. So there will always be countries that will do it themselves, unless and until someone can do it for less, and they can still benefit from space technology development in other arenas besides transportation.
Does China have commercial plans, or is everything they do sort of their national space program?
The only commercial thing in China that I'm aware of is they recently had a launch of a commercial rocket within the past month. I think there was a failure, but I don't remember exactly. I think they're doing a second launch, but that's the only commercial thing in China that I'm aware of. There may be others, but just not aware.
You have another caller. Hang on. Hi, caller. Welcome to the show. Who are you? Where are you, please? Thank you for calling.
Oh, this is John Fort Worth.
Hi, John. How are you?
Pretty good. I was have you moved away from the concepts you were at in the previous space show you're on, where you were really basically launching all modules of that had a hydrogen and oxygen tankage already as fueled and launched? Wasn't that the original idea, or am I misunderstanding that?
No, when we did this before in relation to Constellation, we typically had in our plan to launch empty tanks and to fill them on orbit with propellant, so transferring propellant in. There wasn't the conversion process from water to oxygen, hydrogen, as is in our plan today. But I think what you're remembering are concepts that looked a lot like Delta IV heavy upper stages, and that still has a place in the role, because keeping oxygen and hydrogen together and having modular construction so that if one tank set fails, you can replace it with another tank set. And then it's also beneficial to use any hydrogen boil-off as a vented gas around the oxygen tank to eliminate oxygen boil-off. So that concept approach is likely to stay and is in the plan today. But we never planned on launching them full.
I see.
Well, launching them empty allows us to build them lighter and more efficient, because they don't have to take the launch loads with full of propellant, which is a major impact in the design.
Okay, that was a miss. Okay, I understand now. That's better.
Mm-hmm.
One thing I was kind of also that you get into when you talk about the I think the idea of sending up water as a dense, that's a very sound idea, because obviously it's a denser, easier thing to manage. One issue, though, is at least most of the hydrogen oxygen rockets, as near as I remember from my study of it, I'm not a professional in that particular area, but is that they generally tended to have a higher percentage of hydrogen in the propellant mix than would be a simple H2O output, that they had was it 5 to 1 or something
right,
like that?
Right.
And
no, you're right.
The
RL10 is 5.5 to 1 mixture ratio, which is 5.5 units of oxygen for every unit of hydrogen. The mm-hmm. space shuttle main engine was a little bit better. It was 6 to 1. So for every pound of hydrogen, there were 6 pounds of oxygen. Water is 8 pounds of oxygen for every pound of hydrogen. So one of the technologies that don't exist today but has been tested in small engine scales is a stoichiometric engine, or one that burns oxygen and hydrogen at the water mixture ratio 8 to 1. We don't want to throw anything away. We don't want to mine water to create oxygen that we don't need. A lot of people's first reaction is, well, we can use it for other purposes. We can breathe it. We breathe and consume about 8/10 of a kilogram a day. Or is it an hour? I think it's a day. Anyway, we burn in rockets tons of oxygen in a flight. And so we just can't breathe as much oxygen as we would be throwing away. And there's maybe other processes that could use it, but if we're mining water for propellant, we want to use every drop. And so we really need 8 to 1 mixture ratio engines or stoichiometric engines to make the most use of what we mine and take up as water from the earth.
Yeah.
Otherwise, we may as well just launch oxygen and hydrogen and not have that electrolysis to liquefaction process.
So that was I at one time. The other issue you get into, let me get a little clear here. The other issue is the issue of transferring cryogenics like liquid hydrogen in space. I know there have been issues about that. And I wonder, what is your research and knowledge of the solution to those problems? Do you have do you think you've resolved that one? Or
well, back in 2012. NASA had several contracts out for cryogenic propellant storage and transfer. And the purpose of that was to demonstrate technologies we needed for long-term storage, minimum boil-off, cryogenic propellant transfer, oxygen and hydrogen. And there were four contract studies, and NASA did an internal study, and Boeing, at the time I was with Boeing, I was the project manager on this study, we had suppliers who were going to provide us with a cryogenic coupler to transfer oxygen and hydrogen. We were going to demonstrate that on our proposed spacecraft. There's a company now called Altius in Colorado that has a small business innovative research contract with NASA to develop cryogenic couplers for this process. So the technology hasn't been flown in space. The technology was used on shuttle on the ground, and new technology, new components are being developed today with the goal of doing zero-G cryogenic transfer. So it's coming.
You think by the time this program could get funded, we probably would have the technology high enough maturity level to go with it.
Right, right. If we were funded to build hardware today, that would be one of the things that would be first on the list.
What kind of funding are you talking about for building hardware?
To get to a flight demonstration, $200 to $500 million.
It's a big range.
It depends on the space tug size. It depends on the reusability of it. It depends on where it's going. And 100 of that is for the launch and demonstration mission.
Yeah.
So we have multiple sizes of space tugs in our architecture, and so it depends on which one we need to build first based on what the customer wants.
The problem is finding the customer.
Yeah, like I said earlier, there are potential customers out there, and the problem is demonstrating that this can be done. And how do we get the funding to demonstrate it? So there's this, it's kind of a chicken and egg thing, with a purchase agreement or a lot of letters of interest or commitment letters, contingency letters, if you build it, I have a use for it, take them to the bank for collateral or to other venture funding, not venture capitalists, but other funding sources, other investor sources, and bootstrap that around into a product. But yeah, it's a tall order, and that's the key.
Do you see the customer as also being the investor?
That's a possibility. I've not approached potential customers that way, but that is a possibility.
Is NASA a potential customer?
NASA is a very potential customer. Like I said, they're buying or offering to buy or have a draft request for a proposal on the street for payload delivery services to the moon. Talking about doing that at higher payload levels as well. There's talk of buying services from the Gateway down to the moon. There's talk of lunar cots. Like I said, Allison Zuniga at NASA Ames and Doug Plata, private citizen, promoting lunar cots, which is like the commercial cargo services to the station or commercial crew to the station, where NASA would put up a portion of the development funds. The companies that proposed to develop would come in with the rest of the funds and would make that happen and operate it commercially and then have the opportunity, not the right, but the opportunity to sell services to NASA when NASA is looking for them.
Well, my question about the gateway, why are they putting the gateway in an orbit rather than putting it at the Earth, the Moon, L2, or something like that?
Primarily because the Orion cannot get to L1 or L2 locations. It can get to where they're putting it, which is why they're putting it where they are, the near rectilinear halo orbit. It has, it doesn't take as much delta V from low Earth orbit to the NRHO, the near rectilinear halo orbit. It takes less delta V to get there than it does to get to low lunar orbit, than it does to get to Earth Moon L1 or even Earth Moon L2. And that's where Orion can get, and so that's why it's there.
So that's because of the current service module, if you will, for the term they use now for it, for Orion is really not quite adequate, really.
It's the whole space launch system stack and what it can do, and that's where it can go.
Well, there's a logic to it in the sense that that's what they've developed. That's why it's said all along that they're just trying to find a mission they can do with the hardware that they're building. So, well, I really kind of like these concepts you put out there. I'm really impressed. Years ago, I was thinking of an idea on the idea of building a 50 metric ton to orbit type two-stage rocket, and I realized if you could refuel that thing in orbit, it would have a tremendous ability to project things out the moon or beyond.
Right, which is very much similar to what SpaceX is talking about with their BFR, the Big Falcon rocket, and that is to launch it. It's a two-stage reusable system. Launch it, refuel the second stage in orbit, send it to the moon, and come back 150 tons of payload to the moon. Send it to Mars, refuel it on Mars, and come back and reuse it again. That's what they're doing or proposing to do and talking about. And I know they've tested some tanks of the size needed for the BFR. So they're on their way.
And they're losing oxygen liquid methane, right? And the idea of...
They are, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
But probably with the idea that's been proposed, developing the methane propellant on Mars for return. And,
right. But okay. There's water there, too. And so so my push to use water and oxygen and hydrogen will work on Mars. And Lockheed Martin recently in Australia, end of last year, talked about a reusable Mars lander that would receive water from Earth, go down to the surface, be refueled, and go back up and be stationed at Mars and be capable of being reused over and over again. So there are multiple ideas with multiple propellants out there to go anywhere, Earth, Moon, Mars, you want to go.
Yeah. Well, it all sounds very interesting. Well, I'll get off and let somebody else call in, but I enjoy the ideas that you're proposing.
Thanks, John.
Appreciate your questions.
Thank you.
Listener, John has vacated the line, and we're a little past halfway, so I'm going to take us to break. But the toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. I do answer it if you call during the break. I'll put you on hold. And Dallas and I will be back in about 3 minutes. So don't go anywhere.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with The Space Show. Your support of The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support The Space Show button. Your contribution will help The Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, Your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
I'm Dr. David Livingston, creator and host of The Space Show, and I would like to share my vision with you for not only this radio program, but for space development. Space should be like any other place we choose to visit, work in, or call our home. It should be just another destination, like Tahiti, Hawaii, or any place available to us right now on Earth. When this vision becomes reality, we will be spacefaring in our culture, our economy, our society, and in our lives. Our world will be vastly improved by countless space-related benefits, transforming our lives both in space and right here on Earth. And the Space Show is helping to make this vision a global reality. Welcome back, everybody. Part two of our Tuesday evening program. Our guest tonight, Dallas Binhoff. And I'd like to mention the messages for our sponsors for the second segment. The Integrated Space Plan is sponsoring us. There are the highly developed development chart showing the path to becoming spacefaring. And you can see how the technologies and destinations build upon one another. And the website version expands into all sorts of different elements with a lot of detail. You can see that at thespaceplan.com. You can buy your own copy of the Space Plan. It is suitable for framing. It's very inspiring. So, again, check it out at thespaceplan.com. And Jay Whitner and Ron Jones, who are partners in the organization, are our guests for this coming Sunday. AIAA is our sponsor, the American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics. It's the world's largest aerospace professional society. 30,000 individual members from 88 countries and 95 corporate members. They work in the field every day, so they help to advance the state of aerospace science and technology and increase our knowledge of the universe. Their website for great networking and more is AIAA.org. And their Big Space 2018 meeting, which I wish I could attend, but it is in Orlando again this year, is next week for those of you that are going. And it looks like the hurricane is going to miss Florida this year, so I'm assuming their event will go down just fine. And I will be looking for people to talk about it on the Space Show. And then Celestis is our sponsor, and they are still the only proven company that does memorial spaceflight services in the world. They've been doing that since 1994. And you can do advanced planning and pre-arrangement of a launch if you want to send a portion of the cremated remains of a loved one to space. But you can also do DNA, and you can also mix your DNA with your loved one, so you both can make the trip to either Earth orbit from the Cape or from Vandenberg. The lunar surface, they're going to be going from New Zealand later this year or early next year. Someday they'll go to Mars, and then out of Spaceport America they do suborbital flights. So if this is of interest to you, do contact them. As I've said many, many times, I am their customer on having used multiple flights for my two dogs and my mom. And they're going to the moon if they ever launch this lunar flight. And I will be really paying attention to that one, as I'd love to see the dogs and mom make it to the moon. And this is Celestis.com, C-E-L-E-S-T-I-S. As I've said before, it's one of the favorite companies I've ever done business with. I know it's really weird to say that about a funeral company, but Charlie and his staff and the people are really, really great. They are wonderful people to be involved with. So they get a blue and gold ribbon rating from Dr. Space. Dallas, welcome back.
Thank you.
While all of this has been going on, our good friend in Sweden has been patiently waiting for a reply to this question, which is, what role is there for solar electric propulsion using noble gases in cislunar space?
Well, the upcoming use is the power and propulsion element for the Gateway. At least that's the plan as NASA has envisioned since the asteroid redirect robotic mission was canceled, and also, solar electric will be used for the Mars Transfer Vehicle to go from cislunar space from the gateway out to Mars and back and allow us to recover the transport vehicle and then just resupply it for the next trip. So it's good for moving around in the vicinity of the moon where we can move from L1, L2, these are Lagrange points, the gravitational balance points, the gateway, for very little delta V, and when there's lots of time available between stops or between destinations. And it's good for going interplanetary in order to decrease the time or decrease the amount of chemical propellant one needs and total propellant to make the trip more propellant efficient. Back in, again, when I was at Boeing, I did a trade study on using it between the Earth and the Moon in an architecture similar to what Cislunar Space Development Company is proposing now, a chemical version to get from Earth orbit to the Moon. And the difference in the approach from an all-chemical, all-locked hydrogen architecture and a architecture that included solar electric power and electric thrusters was the number of stages one needed in the architecture to do the same job. We still needed chemical stages for the personnel going back and forth to the moon, so we still had to buy those assets. And in order to get enough propellant out to L1 to get down to the moon, we needed nine space tugs operating continuously using solar electric power to get propellant from Earth orbit to L1 and to get back. It took 9 months to make that round trip. We needed enough propellant to get down to the moon once a quarter. And so one has to buy a lot of assets, a lot of capital expense to do the same job that a chemical stage that we needed to do the people, to move people back and forth could do with one set of vehicles. So in my view, electric propulsion is good for travel between gravity wells, Earth, Mars, but not between the Earth and the moon because you're still in the Earth's gravity well in that distance. So good for interplanetary, not so good for Earth moon.
Is there any way that can be changed or improved on, or you're just talking about the basic physics of doing it?
I'm talking about the current generation of electric thrusters, their thrust level, the amount of power needed to do this, and in order to do it faster, you need more power. And we were talking 400 kilowatt type stages in the study I did at Boeing to move between the Earth and the Moon. The Mars transport vehicle is, I think, on the order of 400 to 500 kilowatts, maybe 700. It's the low thrust that kills it. It gets a lot of gravity losses, a lot of time involved in moving back and forth. So it's the technology we have today. Could there be a breakthrough? Yes. Do I know about a breakthrough that could be had? I have to jump to fusion to do that, and that's even farther away. It doesn't exist today. So that's just the way I see it.
Karen is in Seattle with sort of a shift in the kind of questions away from technology to policy. And Karen says, to what degree is the development of a cislunar system that you're talking about dependent upon Congress understanding what you're talking about, the importance and value of it, and wanting to see it happen, as well as the general public that might be supportive of it if it includes the use of tax dollars? Does it matter what Congress thinks about it or knows about it or what the general public knows about it, or is it bypassing those two key factors?
Of course it matters. And it matters in a lot of ways. It matters in the process of getting approval to launch. You know, the FAA regulates every launch that goes up. The AST office commercial space office there. Launch companies need to get launch licenses, and payloads need to get approved to be launched by the launch vehicles, and that's all collapsed into one process. But we started the process of talking with AST and defining what we want to do and getting them prepared. They take it to several different agencies, NASA, DOD, probably Homeland Security. I'm not sure who all they touch, but they take it to everybody and say, this is what's coming down the pike. Do you have any issues? Are there questions you want to ask, et cetera? And then that package from the payload perspective gets slipped into the launch vehicle licensing process. If we're spending taxpayer money, of course Congress needs to be aware. Congress needs to approve the programs that NASA proposes in response to the administration's direction. The administration says, go do this. NASA defines a plan to do it, and Congress has to appropriate the money and allocate it. So yeah, it matters. But from our approach, what really matters is there a customer that's willing to pay, and who is that customer? And hopefully it's not just the taxpayers. I mean, the plan is to not rely on just the taxpayers' NASA contracts. Like I said earlier, there have been six different potential customers that I have talked with that want to go to four different locations in cislunar space. One of those customers happens to be NASA, and that's just based on the NASA programs. You know, got the gateway there. We may go to the moon, but there are commercial customers out there. I work with another one called Off World that is working to mine the moon, and they are a potential customer of getting their mining equipment to the moon.
You have another email from Randy in Denver. And Randy says, many of us who are very supportive of the new space community believe settlement should be the goal. And obviously the moon is a place for settlement and staying there, along with Mars and possible other locations. How does developing cislunar, as you're talking about, further space settlement as a goal?
Well, it provides the transportation one needs to get to the moon for people and for cargo. We are sizing our landers to do 25 tons to the lunar surface, and that's 25,000 kilograms. And we're doing that because Bigelow wants to put his expandable habitats on the moon, and they're on the order of 20 to 25 metric tons. We need a place to live, where we live in tubes, where we live under the surface, where we dig our habitats, where we fabricate them using 3D printers. We don't know, but any equipment that we need to do that has to be transported there. If people want to live there, they have to be transported there. We are the transportation service that gets them from Earth orbit to the moon surface.
So you're the Greyhound.
We're the Greyhound. We're the a huntsman of space. We're the Burlington Northern Santa Fe. Call it what you will. We are space truckers.
So I'm assuming you contract with available launch services. You're not going to be developing your own launch services.
That's correct. Our service starts in low Earth orbit. We would be collaborating with launch providers so that the customer only needs to buy one ticket to get them from Earth surface to their destination. We would be just part of that ticket with the launch collaborators.
So would you consider launchers from another country, such as Russia or China?
If they could get to where our space tugs are located, yes. And Russia's launch sites aren't there. Would we put our depots and space tugs in orbits that they can get to? It depends on the market. And We're assuming a 28.5 low Earth orbit location as our parking orbit, due east out of Kennedy Space Center. if we need to shift that up a little bit so we could pick up, say Japan or other launch sites, perhaps. But every additional increase in orbit inclination of the Parkin orbit adds operational costs in terms of propellant usage to get to our destination.
Do you have any way to have a realistic estimate of when we might see initial cislunar flight start? Is there any way to ballpark an estimate?
Well, I believe, and I told NASA this in our responses to their request for information, that if fully funded, we could achieve a demonstration flight in 5, at the earliest 7 years at the latest, because it's a matter of integrating existing technology. It's not about developing technology that doesn't exist for the first systems. 5 to 7 years, if fully funded. And of course, that would apply to anybody that wants to do this, or if NASA wanted to fund a program to put infrastructure in, it could be done in 5 to 7 years.
And that would be cargo, right? It would not include people, correct?
The first would be cargo. The personnel module would come later, or may not even need to be fabricated by us. We have the commercial crew to get to LEO, Japan and or ESA. Japan and ESA are collaborating in the Global Exploration Roadmap. They're pictured as having a combined lunar lander, one the descent module, the other the ascent stage with the people in it. And so if they wanted to build that personnel module and put it on our transport vehicle and our lander, that could be done.
Do you have any plans to have a division of your organization, or maybe all of it, take investment from people to help fund some of this? Are there going to be any near-term or maybe intermediate-term investment opportunities for people?
When the time is right. The time is not right today.
And that's for market timing or space factors or all of the above?
All of the above, yeah. It's basically... Customers, are the customers clamoring for the service? Do we have a credible management team that investors would like? What other ways are there to get money? Bank collateral with purchase agreements, you know, when the time is right.
So do you have your team in place, or is that still being developed?
That needs to be put in place.
So are you looking for people, or that is still to be developed too?
I'm always looking. I always have my eyes out, my ears open. But I need to be able to pay people to bring them on, and right now I'm funding everything myself.
Yeah, that's kind of a bad way to...
I know, but that's the benefit of having worked in the industry for so long, and 401ks that Congress has allowed us to keep our tax rates high until we die, and pensions, so that, you know, that's the benefit of beauty of it. I don't need to scrounge and look for anything or a way to survive. I can do this with what I've put away over the years based on help from the government and help from Boeing.
So it used to be like before I started the space show, I was talking at conferences and doing things when I was nearing the end of writing my dissertation, but I hadn't started the space show yet, and there was a huge giggle factor about people going into space tourism, mm-hmm. and all of that. Are you coming into any kind of resistance, or is commercial cislunar sort of an accepted option, actually, and it's taken seriously, and there is no giggle factor with it?
I would say the giggle factor died a few years ago, and this all I think goes back to Elon Musk and SpaceX. It goes, it's certainly reinforced with Jeff Bezos and Blue Origin. New space conferences are no longer about wild ideas that nobody deems possible, but they're about ideas and investors and opportunities and things that people see as valid today. So over the course of the last 10 years, the perspective of what can be done by space in by various organizations and organization sizes has changed a lot.
Absolutely. Plus, the amount of entrepreneurs that are getting money for various kinds of ventures and
right.
and missions that weren't even thought of 5 years ago.
It's kind of mind-boggling. The things that are getting funded today, at least those that I see, are small launch vehicles for small payloads, and then CubeSats and data analytics and Earth observation. That's kind of where the bulk of the stuff is going. But there's other things that are happening that don't get the publicity.
What I find interesting is I will have put an entrepreneurial company on the show a couple of years ago doing something, doesn't really matter what it is.
Mm-hmm.
And now I get contacted by their people running their company or PR, and they're bringing in more money. They're expanding their plans. They want to tell the world about the new aspects of what they're doing over and above what they started out doing two
right.
or 3 years ago. It's never ending. I
mm-hmm.
get these updates and requests for airtime every week from
wow.
people that have been on the show. So that people must be doing something right in the industries that you're talking about.
Well, and you're getting the word out, and people are becoming aware, and people are looking to move off the earth, I guess.
How do you see the big traditional companies responding to all of this in Cislunar? You did mention ULA has a Cislunar 1000 plan.
Right.
Are they going to be part of the formidable competition? You're going to end up competing against the Lockheeds and the Boeings and the ULAs?
I think that will happen when and if NASA starts buying hardware or buying rides. They will definitely become interested if there's money to be had through NASA requests for proposals. And that's okay. Competition is good, but what's really needed, independent of who does it, is reusable space infrastructure in the cislunar environment.
So Tom is calling, and he's from Atlanta, and he says, I was recently watching many of the Mars Society videos that are online from the latest Mars Society conference. Like many of those that were in attendance, I certainly think we should be headed to Mars, but it doesn't seem to me that we need to develop cislunar space to go to Mars. So is cislunar space development competitive to going to Mars? And would it detract or slow down our ability to get to Mars?
Yes and no. I mean, and it depends. If it's a zero-sum game, if we're talking about a NASA budget and NASA doing everything, yes, whatever we do will detract from other things that we want to do. But the pathway to Mars in NASA's plan is via the moon, not the moon's surface, but via the gateway at the moon to get to Mars, because it helps us get to Mars. It allows us to assemble the Mars transfer vehicle at the gateway. It allows the Mars transfer vehicle to use the Earth to give us an energy boost as opposed to using chemical propulsion to get out of the Earth system. It allows us to use that same process to get back into the moon's vicinity when we come back. So it will help get to Mars. The cislunar development and the moon development that I'm talking about, that I'm referring to, is mostly private activity. So it's not contract money. Unless NASA wants to buy a service to get logistics to the gateway instead of sending it themselves. And that's part of their plan, is to have commercial delivery of logistics supplies. Yes and no. It depends.
So another email question for you, and listeners, there's still time if you want to use the phone again, 1-866-687-7223. Paul's in New York, and Paul says, if we're going to do any deep space human spaceflight missions, my understanding is that we need far better life support than we have now. Many think we need to have closed life support systems, which we don't have now. By the time we get around to humans in the cislunar activity that you're talking about, will we have advanced life support? Will we need it going back and forth between Earth and the moon, or would we be able to do it via the life support type of activities we have on the space station?
And for the moon's vicinity, the station hardware, the station technologies are more than adequate. They close the water loop 95% to 98% and they recover oxygen, some of the oxygen from the carbon dioxide. They electrolyze water to get additional oxygen, and if we get on the moon and we're able to extract the water from the moon, we have water there to our heart's desire, if you will, to expand hygiene water, to expand into clothes washing or dishwashing or what, you know, there would be plenty of water available for that. So we don't need closed life support for the moon in terms of water, food. Food would be good to grow food on the moon as opposed to transport. But the food and logistics are a small portion of what goes back and forth to the moon and what causes us to spend propellant. The hardware we take, the people we take, the going back home drives propellant requirements, which is the cost factor, much more than getting food and water to the moon. The reason we need longer life support for Mars is because of the trip time and the inability to resupply or repair on the way there, while we're there, and on the way back. It's a 3-year trip to go and come back. It's 1,000 days. I mean, that's a long time to be without the ability to resupply. Yes, we may be able to get good water on Mars. It depends on where we land. It depends on if we land. But life support is one of the long poles for going to Mars. Radiation protection is another. Zero-G and our time in zero-G, our astronauts' time in zero-G, and will they be able to operate in the Mars gravity once they land, or how long will it be before they can operate safely and efficiently once they land if they spend 6 to 8 months getting to Mars and then 6 to 8 months getting back home? Those are the three life support and health issues as I see them. The bigger issue may very well be social dynamics of a small crew in a small space for a long time.
How many will survive the mission, right?
Exactly. Well, yeah, who's going to get voted off the island, or who's going to get set in a side room because of their inability to interact? That happens with the folks in Antarctica, and that's a large set of people that winter over.
Right, and they have more space than they're going to have inside a spaceship, I would assume.
They most certainly do, and they have a garden, and they have a greenhouse, et cetera.
They have probably better, more real-time communications, I would
say. Exactly, right.
So, Well, it's all going to be fascinating. The sooner we get underway with it all, the more and happier I would be.
And me.
You know, I comment all the time that, you know, there's you wonder how much time one has, especially when we see our friend Paul go in his,
right.
in his mid-60s. But there's a lot to be accomplished, and so much I would like to see happen still while I'm around and at least have the mental facility to know it's happening. But it just seems to drag on and on without a lot of progress. As I was mentioning to you before we started the program, you know, there's a lot of talk. There's unbelievably great ideas out there that are not
right.
attached to money, unfortunately.
Yep.
And we seem to sputter for all sorts of different reasons.
Yep. There are many good ideas. I hope this is one. I hope one of the good ideas get implemented. I hope infrastructure between the Earth and the Moon gets implemented. I hope the Moon Village idea comes about. But like you say, it all boils down to money and how dedicated are people to making these things happen, and are there people with money that also want to see it happen, independent of the return on investment timeline? I know that's important. That's why 5 to 7 years it's really too long for venture capitalists, but it may not be long for legacy investors. Legacy meaning I want to see my name, I want to be remembered for something, or I want to be philanthropic and make something happen.
Have the habitat on the moon named after you, or something.
Right? Yeah,
Buy
your naming rights on the first Starliner, or on the first Vulcan launch vehicle.
Carol is in Portland with a note and said, are there things that we as interested space people, maybe some of us would even be considered space advocates, can do? I personally agree with David when he says it's kind of useless to write letters to members of Congress, but since you're not looking for this to be a government project, I'm not sure writing letters to Congress is where the action is anyway. What can space-interested and knowledgeable people do to help bring about these changes in our space development program and timeline?
Write op-eds, opinion, you know, to your newspapers, write your congressman and tell them that space is important. I mean, that never hurts no matter who does it. It's not necessarily about NASA, but space development is important. Write to Dana Rohrabacher, who wants to be the chair of the Space Committee again in Congress.
Well, he thinks it's important. Hopefully he'll win.
He does.
But he's in a tough race.
Very strong supporter of commercial space, has been for years. But get involved in the space organizations, whether it be AIAA or ISBC, the International Space Conference, National Space Society. Think of something that is needed in space, or go out and develop it, or join organizations that are developing space projects or projects that use space. I mean, there are good down to earth projects that use space are much more saleable than space projects that use space.
You spent your career in aerospace with a big company, Boeing.
Yep.
And would you recommend it to, say, a high school student comes and says, Mr. Benoff, was that a good career? Should I think about that for myself?
I played every day when I, to be blunt. I helped develop the main engine on the space shuttle. I helped design ways to go to Mars and lunar habitats. And I was able to do those fun things for me and get paid for them. I couldn't do what I'm doing today if I hadn't done that then. I'm very grateful for my time at Rockwell and Boeing and what it has allowed me to do then and now. I think they're great. They're great companies to work for. There are some that are better than others. I would not say don't do it. I would encourage people to go where they think they can do what they want to do.
and to pursue that type of a career.
And pursue it, you know, go where your heart is and find a place that you can do what you want to do. My financial advisor told me that I should be doing now what I should have been doing 30 years ago, what I'm doing now. Well, 30 years ago, I couldn't afford to do it. You know, family, et cetera, no savings for retirement, et cetera. I can do it now because of that time at Boeing and Rockwell, and I was able to have fun and do what I wanted to do in that career and push the ideas forward and push the envelope of ideas within Boeing up to a point. So more power to them if that's go where your heart leads you.
Is there anything that we forgot to talk about or missed or something that you wanted to add to the mix that we haven't done yet? Or how do you want to conclude? Any takeaways or what do you want to leave us with?
Oh, wow. Let's go to the moon and let's go to Mars and let's not let one detract from the other. And let's be positive in supporting things that need to be done and not detract from things that are being done. It's better to spend one's energy promoting rather than destroying.
Wise words. Maybe we'll have an opportunity to meet on the moon one day.
I'll have an open door for you. Well, maybe not open airlock.
Yeah, an open airlock. I was going to say you might not last very long with an open door.
Right.
Dallas, we will stay in touch and see how Cislunar development is progressing because it needs to progress.
There's one more thing, and
okay.
That's the Moon Hut project. David Goldsmith, look that up, and you might want to get him to talk about that on your show.
I don't know who he is or about the project. Can
I'll
you
send
me
some information?
Intro? Yeah, and his
right.
email, and I'll contact him.
Right.
So David Goldsmith.
Goldsmith, yeah.
Okay, and it's called Moon Hut?
Moon Hut, yeah. A room, a roof, and a door on the moon.
Okay.
Or four walls, a roof, and a door on the moon.
Just like a hut on the beach, right?
Exactly. That's what we need. And if we had that, how many more people would be interested?
Well, if we could get there and it wasn't too claustrophobic to get there or too expensive to get there, a lot of people would be interested.
All of the above.
Dallas, we will talk to you soon, and I want to thank you again for being with us.
Well, I want to thank the callers and the emailers. It was a fun conversation.
Okay. Listeners, remember, there is no program tomorrow. We're talking about the Space Force with Brian Whedon on Hotel Mars tomorrow. Not sure when Bachelor will have it up for all of us to hear. And then Sunday is the guys behind the Integrated Space Plan. So that's it, everybody. We thank you for calling and participating in tonight's show. And on behalf of Dallas and myself, thank you again for being with us tonight. And everybody, keep looking up. Mars is still visible.
Yeah.
Don't miss it, okay?
Right.
In case you haven't seen it yet, don't miss it. Kind of the southwestern sky, maybe 35 degrees above the horizon.
It was very red.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
But, you know, it doesn't look round. It kind of, you know, it's because of the atmospheric flickering and everything. It kind of looks a little bit like it's long and broken up, and it's weird. That's, again, because of where it is on the horizon.
Yeah.
But it is very red. You cannot mistake it.
Right.
Looks like a bottle of
David.
Ketchup. Thank you, Dallas. And everybody, back again on Sunday for the next live space show program.
All right. Bye.
Goodbye, everyone.